Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. NASA's Hubble Space Telescope is considered to be the most successful celestial observer since the time of Galileo, but it came alarmingly close to being forever dubbed one of America's biggest national embarrassments. Edward Wyler led the telescope project for 20 years. He's here in the studio to talk about a new book on the history of the Hubble and its gifts that it has given to humanity. The book is titled Hubble, A Journey Through Space and Time. And we'll take your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Join us on Twitter. Good morning to you, Dr. Wyler. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. Great to be here.
First of all, tell us about Edwin Hubble, who he was, and why this particular telescope was named after him.
Well, Edwin Hubble was an astronomer back in the early part of the 20th century, early 1900s, who for the first time looked at galaxies, these collections of billions of stars throughout the universe, and he measured the velocity, the speed of these galaxies, and he discovered something very unique. Every galaxy seemed to be going away from us. And the further the galaxy was, the faster it was going away from us, which implied that basically we lived in an expanding universe. So when we had to name the Hubble Space Telescope, well, actually it was called the Space Telescope
yes.
in those days, obviously, we formed a little committee of astronomers, and it was the best committee meeting we ever had because it took about 5 minutes for us to sort of say, hey, why don't we name it after Hubble?
Interesting.
The person who really started this whole field of cosmology.
So put the Hubble Space Telescope into context for us. Why has it been so incredibly important?
Well, you know, the last time we took such a great leap in astronomical capability that Hubble provided over ground-based astronomy, which was about a factor of 10 in resolution or clarity, was when basically Galileo, back in 1610, instead of using his eye, put a telescope in front of his eye, and he increased the clarity by a factor of 10. And, of course, many discoveries came out of that little tiny 1 or 2 inch telescope, like we weren't the center of the universe, there were objects going around Jupiter. And it led to a lot of change in the way we looked at ourselves in the universe. And I think we should have expected this of Hubble, and some of us did, but never the great success we've had.
Give us a little background on how Hubble came into being.
It all started in 1946, and ironically, my first boss, professional boss, was a guy named Dr. Lyman Spitzer. He was at Princeton, and back in 1946, after the war, he worked for the RAND Corporation. And having looked at the V-2 rockets that the Germans were launching during the war, he said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could put a telescope on one of these rockets and put it in orbit and get above the Earth's atmosphere and really see the sky the way it's supposed to be seen? And he published this paper back in 1946, and it was a lifelong effort of his, including helping get it through Congress. And he finally got it through Congress in 1977 for a new start. So it took like 30 years from the publishing of that paper to a new start in Congress and, of course, 1990 when we launched it.
So 10 years mm-hmm. of Hubble. What have we learned?
Oh, boy. And let's see. We don't have enough time on this show to talk about that. But in 20 years, I think the most important things we learned about Hubble and we've discovered with Hubble are things that we had no way of contemplating before we launched it. I used to give talks in 1989 about what we would learn from Hubble and what questions it would answer, like the age of the universe, are there really black holes or is it just Star Trek fantasies? We did all that, you know, and it was great discoveries. But as often the case in science, it's not what you were going after, the questions you knew how to ask. Hubble's enabled us to ask different questions. and told us what we didn't really know about the universe.
Such as,
when I was in graduate school, I was trained that there was a Big Bang, and there was an expanding ball of hydrogen and helium that was moving out into the universe. And that obviously it would take a long time for these individual atoms to join together and form molecules and form bigger globs and eventually evolve into stars and galaxies. And we were trained that would probably take the universe at least 1 to 2 billion years to do that. So we launched Hubble, knowing full well we had the capability of looking back in time to within 1 billion years of the Big Bang. So thus we would obviously see the birth of stars and galaxies. Well, the universe didn't read the textbook that I read. It had the nerve not to listen to our human textbooks. And what did we see when we looked back to 1 billion years after the Big Bang? We didn't see baby galaxies, to use a human analogy. We saw, you know, 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds, you know, kindergarten kids in galaxies, clearly indicating the universe had the nerve to get started making stars and galaxies long, long, long before we ever thought it could.
Edward Weiler, he's an astrophysicist, leading scientist at NASA. He served as chief scientist to the Hubble Space Telescope from 1979 to 1998. Currently, he's the associate administrator for the Science Mission Directorate of NASA, and he's here to talk about a brand new book filled with the most glorious photographs taken by the Hubble telescope. The book is called Hubble, A Journey Through Space and Time. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You know, I was on the air when the Challenger accident occurred. I shall never forget that day. You have other reasons to remember that day because it affected the Hubble project seriously. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we were about ready to launch the Hubble in the late 80s until the Challenger accident occurred, and we lost those brave astronauts, and that was the most distressing part. The effects on Hubble were not, you know, anywhere near that, obviously. It wound up, the shuttle, of course, was grounded until NASA could figure out what happened, until we knew exactly what happened and felt safe to fly again. And we started flying again later in the 1980s, and Hubble was delayed a few years and was launched then in April 24th, as a matter of fact, 1990.
So here we are, 20 years later, but not without a few problems here and there. Tell us about when you discovered the problem with Hubble's main mirror, what you call the worst day of your life.
It was clearly the worst day of my life. The best day of my life was April 24th, 1990. We were all on top of Mount Everest. Suddenly, we astronomers who had never done interviews were on the Today Show, Nightline, and you know, everybody loved the Hubble. And it was launched with a lot of public interest, worldwide, I might add. And it only took about a month to discover that things weren't going very smoothly. We were having trouble with solar panels that were vibrating, and we had trouble finding stars in our star trackers. And worst of all, focusing the telescope was taking a lot longer than we expected. And it really wasn't an I gotcha moment. It was an evolutionary process, because none of us wanted to believe that there could be a serious problem with this billion-dollar telescope. But slowly, the evidence started mounting, and, you know, scientists and engineers tend to believe data when the data is compelling. And by about early June of 1990, even the most skeptical of us had to accept the fact we had the world's best mirror, the world's most perfect mirror, the world's most smooth mirror, smooth to a millionth of an inch accuracy, except it had the wrong prescription. That is, it had the wrong curve.
Ugh.
It was ground down at the edges about a fiftieth of a human hair too much glass was taken off. And that was enough to cause something called spherical aberration. Basically, for the normal person in the public, that's sort of like if you're like me and nearsighted, you take off your glasses, you can't, your eyes don't focus all the light in the right place. Everything's fuzzy. That was basically the problem we had with the Hubble. So when we announce this to the world, we at NASA tend to share these things, even when they're bad news, as soon as we find out. So on June 27th was the worst day of my life.
So what did you do?
I stuck it out. You went home? Well, I had the honor of explaining the impact of science for NASA. Some of my bosses happened to be out of town, but anyway, no, just kidding. Because I was a chief scientist, I had to tell the world that we weren't going to produce the pictures that we thought we would. On the other hand, on that same day, we had discovered, literally almost that same day, we had come up with a fix we thought might work. And I announced that at the same press conference. I said, it's really a problem now, but we think we have a way to fix this, and we plan to fix it in December of 1993. Nobody in the press audience believed us. You know, I don't think there was a person in there who believed us. They thought we were just trying to spin good news. But the bottom line is, history will show, on December 18th, 1993, we got the first pictures down from that first servicing mission, and we nailed it, obviously.
How in the world did you fix that telescope?
As my own senator in Maryland likes to say,
Barbara Mikulski,
we basically designed eyeglasses for the Hubble. And again, the analogy carries forth. My eye is, I'm nearsighted. Without my glasses, I can't focus. But it's not because I don't have a good eye. I have a perfect eye. It just has the wrong curve. And what the eye doctor does, he or she designs a piece of glass that's curved the opposite way, which totally corrects for the problem with my own eye. So we don't use lenses in Hubble. We were actually lucky enough to be building a camera.
Edward Weiler, he is an astrophysicist. We're talking about Hubble, a journey through space and time. And just before the break, Edward Weiler, who served as chief scientist of the Hubble Space Telescope from 1979 to 1998, was explaining how, after it was discovered that Hubble was nearsighted, its vision was somehow corrected.
Right. We luckily, before we launched the Hubble, some of us thought about the fact that, you know, we've got five instruments on the Hubble, scientific instruments, but one of them is really critical. It's a wide-field camera, and it was going to take the kinds of pictures that not only would do great science, but also be the connection from Hubble to the average person in America or the world. Because people can understand pictures. It's harder to understand spectra or photometry. So we sold this to the Congress. We suggested we start building a backup camera before we launch the original telescope. And boy, was that lucky we did that. Little did we know that backup camera would then serve to be the fix for the Hubble Space Telescope.
How was it the fix?
Because after we launched the Hubble and we discovered the mirror had a prescription problem, the designer of the backup camera, John Trauger, said, you know, there are four little tiny mirrors the size of nickels in my camera. And if I change the shape of those mirrors to cancel out the problem in the big mirror in Hubble, we'll have a perfect image.
So he could do that from his laboratory.
Because we were still building that camera as a backup. So he changed the surface of those four little mirrors. We launched that 500-pound camera in 1993 on the space shuttle. We put that camera in there, and on December 18th, 1993, we're all up in Baltimore at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and that was the cathartic moment because the first picture came down, and it wasn't fuzzy. It was crystal clear, and the stars looked like little points, and it was hallelujah.
Wow. Must have been just extraordinary. What do you think are some of the most important findings made possible by Hubble?
I think if you ask that question to any astronomer, they'd all have different answers. So these are my personal favorites.
Sure.
The time we decided to spend 37 hours or 38 hours of Hubble observing time to look at one tiny patch of the sky and take a long time exposure. It's like taking your 35 millimeter camera out and for 37 hours with the lens open. You get a lot more light coming in. So this is going to be the deepest photograph ever taken by humans of the universe. And the part of the sky we looked at was only 1/200,000,000th of the sky. The size of if you hold a sewing needle at the end of your arm and look through the hole, that's the size of the sky we looked at. Yet when we got that picture back, it had thousands, I think over 5,000 galaxies. And each one of those galaxies has hundreds of billions of stars. But most importantly, it was like looking through a time tunnel, because we discovered galaxies that were well formed very, very early in the universe, much earlier than our textbooks ever said they could be. And that one picture really told us that most of us astronomers had learned the wrong universe. The universe we live in was different than one we were taught.
You have a favorite galaxy. Which is it?
My favorite galaxy actually isn't in the book, but it's M100. And the reason it's my favorite, not for science reasons, but it's the galaxy that we took a picture of right after we'd fixed the telescope. And we happened to have a picture of that galaxy before we fixed the telescope. And it was actually Senator Mikulski held those two pictures up at the press conference the day we announced the fix. And her famous quote was, "The trouble with Hubble is over." And any American, not just an astronomer, looking at those two pictures could understand, hey, it's like putting your glasses on.
You know, we do have many of these photographs that are in the book up on our website, drshow.org. So if you'd like to see them, do go there. Here's an email from John, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. He says, "What are the current limitations of Hubble? What can we expect from Hubble's successor? And when can we expect to see it?"
Current limitations on Hubble, we did the final servicing mission with the space shuttle. As you know, the space shuttle won't be flying after about another year, so there'll be no more servicing of the Hubble. But I think since we replaced all the gyroscopes, all the batteries, put two brand new instruments in, Hubble is probably, I hate to make predictions, but it's good probably for at least 5 more years, and there's no reason why it couldn't last 7 or 8 or 9 more years of doing even better science than it has been doing. In terms of expectations beyond Hubble, its follow-on is called the James Webb Space Telescope, and it's going to be launched in the summer of 2014. Hopefully Hubble will still be working too. And it's going to be about 100 times more sensitive than the Hubble Space Telescope because of the incredible leap in technology that we've experienced since Hubble was launched back in the 1990s. And James Webb was actually designed and built to answer the question that Hubble created. Remember, I've been talking about finding these baby galaxies where we thought we shouldn't see anything. It became very apparent after Hubble took these deep field shots of the universe that the universe got started very early in its existence. And if we humans have any philosophical or scientific desire to kind of understand how this all began and how matter started forming into stars and galaxies, we needed a telescope much larger and much more sensitive than Hubble. And the James Webb telescope was actually proposed because of that one picture I've been talking about, that Hubble deep field. We clearly didn't understand how fast the universe got going. And being inquisitive people, we'd like to know how.
And how much will that James Webb telescope cost?
Right now, it's presently budgeted at about $4.5 to $5 billion, which sounds like an awful lot compared to Hubble. But remember, if you take the $1.6 billion that Hubble cost and put that into today's dollars after inflation, we're going to get 100 times more sensitivity from James Webb for about the same price as Hubble.
Here's another email from Richard in Ann Arbor. He says, current plans call for splashing Hubble after it ends its useful life. It wouldn't require much more energy to lift it to a 1,000-year parking orbit where it could be an orbiting museum piece, or from which it could be retrieved by more advanced technology, perhaps in time for the 1,000th anniversary of Columbus.
You're looking at a person who always dreamed of going up there with a space shuttle at the end of Hubble's mission and bringing it down and putting Hubble into the Air and Space Museum for kids to actually be able to see the telescope that filled their textbooks, with science. However, that dream of mine and many others was kind of dashed after the Columbia tragedy and the fact that we now send shuttles only to a certain inclination that orbit that goes that has the space station as a safe haven. So it's really difficult to get to the Hubble orbit, and there won't be shuttles flying anyway. So right now the plan is, and of course plans change, but the plan is Hubble's orbit will start to decay in the mid-20s. So we're talking 15 years from now. So no need to panic quite yet.
And Bill in Westminster, Maryland says, feel free to spend my tax dollars on service missions 5 and 6, and as long as Hubble is producing good science, this has been an amazing tool. Now, do I understand correctly that you believe we may eventually find life other than our own somewhere in the universe?
I think that's an excellent question, and there's been an evolution in thinking about that. When I was in college a long, long time ago, 30 years ago almost now, the field of biology, if you talk to biologists about life in general, how did it start here? It was kind of like the Goldilocks. I'm downplaying it here, but it's not that far from reality. Life was a quirk. It evolved on Earth because things were just right here on Earth. So-called Goldilocks theory. Just right, not too hot like Venus, not too cold like Mars. I'm oversimplifying, obviously, for effect. But, obviously, life was a rare thing. But biology, like astronomy, has evolved over the last 30 years. Biologists are now finding that life is almost everywhere you look, as long as there are three ingredients: water, energy, and organic material. And wherever you find those three, whether it's 10,000 feet below the ocean, where you wouldn't think there'd be life, but these four-foot-long tube worms seem to do quite well near volcanic vents, toxic waste dumps, nuclear waste dumps, Antarctic ice, if you have those three ingredients, life seems to find a way. Well, you could argue, but those ingredients only exist here on our Goldilocks planet. Not quite so. The universe is pervaded with energy. We find with radio telescopes and other telescopes that organic material is all over the place, in our own galaxy and other galaxies. And water, we're finding almost every place we look. Interstellar dust and gas, below the surface of Mars, water permeates the universe. So why would life only choose Earth to grace?
So then it would depend on how one defines life.
Well, I'm talking about life in its most rudimentary, right now you can tell me that, prove that life exists other than the Earth. I can't. But if I find one bacterium or one fossil of a bacterium any place else but on Earth, that's a tremendous move forward for humankind, because it shows that life evolves someplace else by itself without us contaminating.
Do you believe that the James Webb telescope could tell us about some form of life elsewhere?
I don't even think I'm going out on a limb here. I think that in this century, This is especially a message for our young kids out there to want to be scientists, engineers, and mathematicians. In this century, humans are going to do something that humans have been asking about since cavemen and women looked at the stars and answer the question, are we alone? We have the technology. Sooner or later in this century, we're going to find fossils on Mars if they exist, or existing life on Mars if it exists, perhaps in the oceans of Europa, and certainly in the atmospheres of other planets around other stars. If we find evidence in those atmospheres of those other planets of water vapor, carbon dioxide, okay, and oxygen, ozone, we've proved life exists on that planet, because you can't have those elements without life. We wouldn't have any oxygen on the Earth's in the Earth's atmosphere if it weren't for trees, grass, and plants. They produce the oxygen. If all the vegetation on Earth were wiped out for some reason, in 100 years or 200 years, there'd be no oxygen left. So if you find oxygen in a planet's atmosphere, it's a pretty good indication in combination with those other elements that there's life.
What kind of life do you think we might find?
Right now, I'd settle for a bacterium. If you're asking about intelligent life, well, let me put it this way. Especially if there's any kids listening, write down the number 1 followed by 23 zeros. That's how many stars like our sun exist in the universe that we can count. And you could say, oh, but stars don't all have planets. Well, we're finding that most young stars do have the process of producing planets, and we're finding lots of planets. I'll give you that only 1 in 10 stars may have planets. So take a zero off, 1 followed by 22. Oh, yeah, but if they're planets, not all of them are Earths. Right, I'll take another factor 10 off, 1 followed by 21 zeros. You get where I'm going here?
Yeah.
You have to be pretty, pretty arrogant to think that we are the only place on Earth, only place in the universe that has life.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850, and go first to Arlington, Virginia, to Dan. You're on the air.
Yes, I attend lots of public lectures by scientists using the Hubble, yet in these 20 years, never once have I heard any of these scientists ever thank the American public for paying for this wonderful telescope. Don't you think that this is very dangerous and even arrogant oversight in these challenging times? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling.
I'm glad you asked that question, and you would have got your thank you in perhaps a different way if I were asked the question, what's the most important thing Hubble has done? I'm an astronomer, and it's great that astronomers love Hubble and they're very happy, but that's not the most important thing Hubble has done. The most important thing Hubble has done is brought science to the American people and especially American school kids. I will consider that Hubble was worth the money we spent on it if it's excited a few of our school kids, thousands or tens of thousands, to take science, engineering, and math as possible careers. If Hubble can do that, it's worth every single penny we spent on it.
And presumably all the scientists working on this project or other projects having to do with space would thank the American public for their taxpayer contributions.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why we work so hard to get Hubble data to the American public through the media, and more importantly to our American kids. We reach millions of kids with Hubble data every year.
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Ken.
Hey, good morning, guys. One of my favorite topics here. 2 quick questions.
Good.
You mentioned the deep field. That was a time exposure to look back 1 million years after the Big Bang. Why not do a month time exposure, an even deeper field? Secondly, I'd heard that at the Big Bang, most people like myself had the impression that matter and energy were thus created out of a single point. But I hear theories now is that not just matter and energy, but space itself was created, and space banged and expanded, and that actually the outer limit, the shell of known space, 3 dimensions, is actually expanding faster than the speed of light. And it's bigger than, you know, maybe just the mere outward boundary of matter and energy. Anyway, maybe you can appreciate that if I didn't phrase it exactly right.
No, you're talking about a lot of theories out there. You know, the Big Bang was a point and it expanded. Whether it created space itself or whether space existed before that is an interesting theory. I tend to be an observationalist scientist. That is, I like things I can test by observation. A lot of the theories you're referring to are something we could never test by observation. But I'd like to throw another thing for you to think about since you like theories. We always use the word, the letter capital U when we talk about universe, implying it's the only universe. What if we thought of the Big Bang as a grain of sand on the beach, and every single other grain of sand is another Big Bang and another universe in an infinite beach? So sleep on that one.
Edward Weiler, he's an astrophysicist, leading scientist at NASA. He served as chief scientist at the Hubble Space Telescope from 1979 to 1998. He's the associate administrator for the Science Mission Directorate of NASA. We'll take a short break. More of your calls when we return. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Stephen Sondheim turned 80 last month, and there are many celebrations, including a new roundabout theater production called Sondheim on Sondheim. On the next Fresh Air, we get to wish Sondheim a happy birthday and talk with him about his life and music. Join us.
Back to the phones with your questions on the Hubble Telescope to Richmond in Kennewick, Washington. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I've designed and worked on a lot of telescopes over my life, and we never built one where we didn't set up and test the optics first. And if the manufacturer, I guess it was PerkinElmer, did set it up and test the optics, why didn't they find the aberration? And if they didn't test it, why in the world didn't they?
There were several tests done by the contractor, PerkinElmer. Regretfully, one piece of test equipment didn't quite come into focus, and thus showing the problem. But they were able to get this piece of equipment to get it into focus by inserting a little washer about a third of a millimeter thick, which, of course, was not standard procedure, and I wish it had been reported to NASA, but it wasn't, as the investigation found out. So you're absolutely right. On the James Webb Telescope, for instance, we are spending enormous amounts of money to be absolutely sure that this thing is in focus, and there's a lot more government oversight in watching the testing.
Richmond, I'm glad you called. Here's an email from Ray, who says, please comment on the role of Senator Barbara Mikulski in helping save the Hubble from early termination until replacement telescope was launched. She led the congressional fight to save Hubble in late 2004, early 2005, based on the interest of her constituents, which included, of course, the Goddard Space Research Center, and letters from thousands of school children. I believe the nation owes Senator Mikulski a great debt.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've known the senators from before launch. I mean, I was just a young astronomer working on Hubble, and I was had the honor of showing her the pictures that proved it was fixed the day of the press conference. I mean, that's one of the greatest honors I had in my life. The senator has been an advocate for Hubble, but more just as importantly, an advocate for science in this country and getting our kids excited about science. It's not just Maryland. She really is a super advocate for science, and I just can't say enough about her support over the years.
And, of course, the astronauts, they are also part of this story.
Yes, thank you, Diane. Hubble is a robotic mission, and, you hear a lot of talk about the debate between robotic missions versus human missions. Hubble merges those two in the best possible way. If it weren't for astronauts risking their lives on five missions, six if you include the launch, Hubble would be a piece of orbiting space junk. It wouldn't be the most successful science mission in the history of humankind. It was astronauts who went up there and saved the Hubble and then made it better many times after that. In fact, five servicing missions. So I can't say enough about the astronauts, men and women, who went up there and saved the Hubble and then made it better every single time they touched it.
A number of our emailers want to know about your belief in God and whether that has or has not changed because of your work in science.
Well, obviously, that's a very personal question, and I don't want to go with too much. I was raised a Catholic, and I slowly, as I studied more and more in college and graduate school, I slowly, some might say I lost my religion, became an agnostic. That doesn't mean I don't understand religion. I don't respect the right of people to believe in whatever they wish to believe in. The way I lead my life is I base it on what I can observe and what I can see in terms of scientific data. And Hubble has convinced me that the universe is something we humans, although we're minor biology on a minor planet around a minor star, we're doing a fairly decent job of learning about the universe and seeing how it works. And the data, to me, convinces me that we kind of understand how it evolved and got here. If you ask me the question, what was before the Big Bang, I can't answer that question as a scientist because there's no data. That's a question for philosophers, theologians, and belief.
So how does it make you feel when you learn that in classrooms around the country, evolution is no longer being taught?
Well, that's especially close to the heart because I'm married to a biologist at University of Maryland, and actually your guest tomorrow, Ed Wilson, was her thesis advisor. So a little coincidence there. I'm not a biologist, but I've studied evolution, and just like the evolution of the universe, the data is compelling. If the data tells you a theory is more than a theory, that it's supported by the data, I at some point you got to accept it. On the other hand, I understand people have beliefs, and I don't want to question their beliefs. But I speak for myself. The data to me is compelling, both the evolution of the universe and the evolution of life on the Earth.
All right. To Gaithersburg, Maryland. Good morning, Phil.
Hi. I called to ask, people are talking again about doing a manned mission to Mars, which is supposed to cost, I think, about 30 times as much as the Hubble did. And I wondered how you feel about the relative value in terms of scientific results of sending a man into Mars instead of sending a robot to Mars. Is it going to produce, for 30 times the cost of the Hubble, will it produce even one-tenth as much science as the Hubble?
Well, the first thing I like to say is that I'm not so sure it'll be a man versus a woman. Hopefully it'll be both, but I understand the question. I maintain that if we're ever going to really answer the question, did life ever evolve on Mars? Is it still there underground? The only way we're going to answer that question is not with the random robot that we sent. I'm in charge of the Mars rovers, and I'm in charge of the robotic Mars exploration program. And it's a very good program, and it does great science, a lot of science. But ultimately, if we're going to answer the most fundamental questions we have as humans, you know, does life exist in the universe? I think the only way we're going to answer that someday is by a human biologist, whether it's female or male, going to Mars, because I don't know how I train a robot with the intuition of knowing which rock to turn over, where to drill the holes. I believe in human scientists going to places like Mars and doing that. Yes, it's going to be a lot more expensive, but I think someday it'll be done, because it's not just about the mission. It's about the tremendous technologies that will come out of that, and we could spend a whole show on all the technologies that came out of the moon program. So we've got to take a broader perspective, not just the science.
So what do you think of the president's plan for space?
I think President Obama setting the ultimate destination at Mars is exactly the right thing to do. Mars, you know, it's not just exploration. Mars is also, you know, it's full of science. I mean, life, geology, why is Mars now dry? We know it was really wet before. You know, what happened to Mars? What kind of global climate change happened to Mars? There's a lot we can learn about our own planet by going to Mars. And Mars has more surface area than the Earth in terms of dry ground. A lot of people think of it as a small planet, but it doesn't have any oceans. So everything on Mars is land. And it has more land than the Earth.
Do you think it, at one time, had oceans?
We know that there was standing water on Mars. Our robotic missions have shown that. We see layered terrain. I mean, I've been in Colorado River Valley, where you see the layers from the water levels. We've seen that same kind of evidence on Mars. We see dried up river valleys. And now we're finding ice underneath the ground, and not miles, but inches under the ground, and not just at the poles, but at mid-latitudes, like the latitude of Montreal. So if we sent humans there, there's going to be water to drink, to turn into oxygen, and to turn into hydrogen for fuel.
Would you have loved to be the person going to Mars?
When I was a young graduate student and we had already been to the moon, and John Kennedy set an impossible goal for this country. But thank goodness he did, because it really got this country together and huge technologies came out of it. I believe if we go to the moon from nothing to the walk driving SUVs on the moon in 10 years, surely we'll be on Mars by 1990. And I would have given my right arm to be one of those astronauts.
But you weren't.
No, but Vietnam intervened and a few other priorities
came. Working on the ground. Let's go to Waxahachie, Texas. Good morning, Deborah. You're on the air.
Good morning. I haven't been able to hear the entire discussion, so you may have already answered this question. But I've always wondered, you know, if things are so far apart from each other in space, you know, we're talking light years, how is it that the Hubble telescope can take a picture of something that is so far away? Does that make sense?
Sure. No, it's a good question. And it's one of the hardest things to explain to students, especially because, we here on Earth are in the present, obviously. Everything we look at with Hubble is in the past, because it takes light time to get from one place to another. It doesn't travel at infinite speed. It travels at a mere 186,000 miles per second. But the universe is a big place. So when we say we're looking at a galaxy that's a billion years after the Big Bang, that means it's about 12 billion light years from us. 12 billion light years, all that means is that the light left that galaxy 12 billion years ago and has been traveling ever since. We're not seeing that galaxy as it looks today. We're seeing it as a little baby or a little preschooler. So always the way you understand this is to remember that light takes time to travel. Just like a baseball doesn't leave a pitcher's hand and get to the plate immediately. It takes, you know, half a second or a second. Well, think of the distances involved in the universe and you'll start to see why.
Does that help, Deborah?
A little bit. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's kind of hard to really
frame. It sure is.
What I'm wondering.
Yeah, I understand. Thanks for calling to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Hey, two things I was wondering about, then I'll take your discussion off the air. The first is that it wouldn't surprise me one bit to find life out there in the universe, but it wouldn't surprise me one bit if we did not find any life, because I know there is a God. And the second, I wonder if your experts could relate this, that mad cow disease, spongiform, is supposedly not alive, yet they know it's contagious. And I'm wondering if our definition of life might be off just a bit, because DNA is made of genes, and genes are made of simple proteins, which is what a mad cow disease agent is. And perhaps that even a single atom and energy itself could be living, because all things are a part of God's body.
Thanks for calling.
You know, I'm not a PhD in biology, so I can't really get into that. My very basic understanding of the definition of life is something that self-replicates, like a cell can self-replicate. But the caller is right. The definition of life itself is a very interesting one, because we talk about life on Earth. All of our life here is carbon-based. It's around the carbon atom. Carbon is a great atom because it's got a lot of electrons and a lot of valences, if you know your chemistry. There are other atoms that could fill that role of carbon, for instance, silicon. Some biologists have proposed the concept that there can be whole planets that are based on silicon life forms. So the caller makes a good point. The definition of life is not something that's hard and fast.
How would you describe the Obama administration's attention to climate change, and how does it interact with the work that you are doing?
Well, first on climate change, it's clear that this president has a priority in understanding what's happening to the Earth and how it may be changing. We just got a $2.4 billion increase in the president's proposed budget over 5 years for Earth science. Earth science has been going down and down and down over the past 8 years. So this is a renewed emphasis on, you know, how is our planet changing? Is it changing? How much? And how fast is it changing? But in general, I think it's fair to say this president's very supportive of science. These are very difficult budget times, obviously. But for the president to support a stable science program in astrophysics or solar physics and an increasing program in earth science is very reassuring, because science is our future.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now to Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Ed. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say how I appreciate hearing this and all the science information we've obtained from Hubble and the Mars rovers and so forth is, I think, very useful in us learning about ourselves and the universe. I've studied astronomy, radio astronomy, and so forth, and I sure appreciate the things I've learned in those subjects. And I've built several telescopes myself, figured my own mirrors and so forth. And this show is very interesting, and I appreciate hearing it. And I've learned a lot of things on the show here that I didn't know before about details about the Hubble and so forth.
I'm glad, Ed. Thanks for calling. And finally to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Dan. Quick question, please.
Yeah, Ed, this is Dan Denhoff from the class of 67, St. Ignatius High School, Chicago.
How about that?
Oh, my goodness. Hi, Dan.
Anyway, I'd just like to say congratulations on all your fine work with Hubble and the Mars program. And one other thing, it's been a lot closer to 40 years since we were in college than 30.
Hey, don't tell me.
The other thing is the class of 67 is getting together this summer for a Sox game on July 8th, if you're in town.
Hey, send me an email, please. I'm in the book.
Okay, very good. And always a pleasure following your career, and it's great talking to you.
Thanks.
And thanks for calling. Last question about junk in space. How much is there?
A lot more than there was before 1960. It's becoming a real problem. because not only do we leave rocket, we have to leave rocket boosters up there that get our satellites up there, and they take a long time to decay. But sometimes these boosters hit other boosters, and it creates little junk. It's becoming a bigger and bigger problem.
How are we going to deal with that?
There are several teams studying that very problem as we speak. There are a lot of ideas. Some of them are more wild than others. But
isn't there a way to use material that would of itself disintegrate?
Well, the material—it's not so much a problem with it coming down and hitting somebody in the head on Earth.
Yeah.
Most of the material will burn up in the atmosphere because when you enter at 18,000 miles per hour, you create a lot of friction. The real problem is for other satellites.
Edward Weiler, he's an astrophysicist and a leading scientist at NASA. He served as chief scientist at the Hubble Space Telescope. The new book with glorious pictures, some of which you can see at our own website, drshow.org, is titled Hubble, A Journey Through Space and Time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.